Hazel Khan, and you're listening to North Fork Works. I'm very happy to be sitting on a lovely day outside at the farm where Abra Morawick and her partner Chris run their farm, Feisty Acres. This is the fourth time that I'm actually meeting Abra. The first time, Abra, was March 2019, before the COVID era. There'd been a gathering convened by Steph Gaylor, and there was you and
Phil Barbado of Biophilia was there.
And Laura Clary was there, and Steph, of course.
Yes.
And biodiversity was that your memory of it?
Yeah, biodiversity and how it affects people who farm for a living here on the North Fork. Because in order to grow biodiverse crops, people have to want to buy them. Just because you're growing it doesn't mean people want it, right?
So it means they have to be educated, too, about what it's all about. Mm-hmm. You've been very effective through your newsletter, which is a wonderful newsletter. And I think you do some other writing too, don't you?
Yes, I'm currently writing for North Fork Neighbors or NoFo Neighbors. Stephanie Alani reached out to me. Yeah, she approached me at the beginning of this year and asked if I would write, and I said absolutely.
It's a wonderful newsletter. It's just incredibly educational, and it's also very personal.
Thank you.
It's terrific. I always read it.
Thank you. It means a lot. Thank you.
Yeah. You're an important source of information about these things on the North Fork, and I commend you for that. Then the next time that you and I met was when I interviewed you to talk about just your farm. Mm-hmm. And you took me on a tour in an older red truck than this.
It's the red truck that Chris has right now. Yeah. Yeah.
And you took me around, and it was wonderful, and I was able to get all the sort of extraneous sounds of birds doing their thing. It was very nice. And then the next time I interviewed you was in June 2020, in the middle of COVID.
Yep.
I wanted to know how you and other small farms on the North Fork were weathering COVID.
Right.
But now I want to take you to what I think is a new expertise, and that came out of one of your latest newsletters, and that's the Good Shepherd Conservancy. And I know nothing about it, other than what you've told me. So I'm giving you the mic. I'm asking you to please continue. Introduce our listeners to the Good Shepherd Conservancy and just go from here, please.
Absolutely. So the Good Shepherd Conservancy is named after the Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch in Lindsborg, Kansas. And it is owned and operated by Frank Reese Jr., who's a fourth generation farmer there on the Kansas Prairie. He raises standard bred poultry for commercial markets. He's the only farm left in the United States that is doing so. He raises over 10,000 birds a year, at least. And he is an important source of biodiversity in the poultry world because close to 98% of the birds raised for meat, whether it's by a large or small farm, is the product of hybridization in a breed. And those genetics that lead to that hybridization are actually only owned by two companies in the world, Aviagen and Kopp.
So that's even more concentration.
Yeah. We also raise hybrids for meat and for eggs alongside standard bred and heritage poultry. But it's people don't realize that almost all the breeds that are available for meat are hybrids. So whether it's a Cornish cross, a red broiler, a red bro, a royal red, a kosher king, those are all hybrids. Even though they have different qualities and different colors and stuff, they're all still F14 hybrids. But we'll get into that later.
So hybrid is something that's simply that's not purebred?
Hybridization can mean so many different things depending upon what industry within agriculture you're talking about. But specifically here in poultry, it means that if your bird breed is a standard bred bird breed or a heritage bird breed, the male and the female of that breed should be able to mate true. And that means that once they mate, their offspring will have the same traits or a mix of the same traits as the mother and the father. Okay, so that's one of the many standards a bird must meet in order to be called standard bred. The hybrids that we raise and that everybody else raises, they're generation F14 hybrids. So it's almost physically impossible for them to mate naturally because of the way that they grow out. They have a lot of breast meat and that kind of weighs them down. And they also have problems in their skeletal structures because they grow so quickly, their skeletons cannot keep up with the growth of their muscle.
How quickly do they grow?
Hybrid breeds usually grow out within 8 weeks. Some grow out within 6 weeks, and some grow out within 12 weeks.
Grow out means ready for eating?
Ready for market, yes.
Really?
Correct.
6 weeks?
6 weeks, yeah. I've definitely raised those. I've helped other farmers raise those when I worked on their farms, and it was really It was both incredible and terrifying. Do you know what I mean? It's incredible that they can grow so quickly in a short amount of time with such little resources.
That's called factory farming, right?
Right. But you can still do it on pasture. You're still raising these breeds that are owned by companies in the world.
You don't have to do anything special to get them to market in 6 or 8 weeks.
No, you have to keep them clean. You have to keep them fed, keep them as comfortable as you can, and then they're ready to go. Those are breeds that are really meant to be raised indoors. They don't walk around much. All they want to do is sit around and eat. They have all white feathers, and so that makes them really easy to clean for market. So we all raise those. Most of us are raising hybrids, for sure. So one of the standards of standard bred poultry is that they have a slow growth rate to market. The minimum for a chicken would be 16 weeks, which is twice the amount of time as a hybrid chicken.
And costs twice as much, presumably, as well.
Oh, at the very least. Let's talk about feed to weight conversion.
So for every pound they eat, how much meat do they deliver?
Right. For every 1 pound of meat that you get off of a hybrid bird, let's say a Cornish cross, you have to feed them 3 pounds, which is 6 to 8 weeks. If you want to raise a standard bred bird to market to at least 16 weeks, at least double that. Not only do they take longer, but they do take more resources to reach that weight.
And that money's not being used for something else.
Correct. From that standpoint, you can see why standard bred and heritage poultry would fall out of favor for farmers that need to make a living.
Can you charge twice as much for that meat?
We have been able to here, but we live in the middle of the Hamptons in New York City. The rest of the country where farmers are located, they don't have as big a markets as these two markets that we're right smack dab in the middle of. Just because you grow it doesn't mean people want it. We talked about naturally mating, and we talked about they have to be able to be a breed that exhibits very strong foraging behaviors and the ability to live outside in a pasture-based environment. So it's really important that these birds are not only thrifty and smart, but are good at picking out grasses and seeds and bugs from where it is they're living. It's important that because they're outside, that they have strong immune systems because they're exposed to so much more environmental hazards than your Cornish cross that's raised in the barn. Birds can get worms, birds can get cuts on their feet and get bacterial infections. But if you raise a lot of these standard bred birds, they're just extraordinarily hardy.
So how does the bird feed calculation, the financial calculation of the feed, how do you factor in the natural foraging food?
That's a good question. So it really depends upon the quality of your pasture.
Some of the photographs of your birds in pasture, amazing pasture. I wouldn't mind being a bird if I could eat like that.
Yes. We're working on the one that we're currently leasing. This is our first time. The pasture that you saw, we'd actually put years into that pasture. And improving pasture really does take years, if not generations, depending upon how badly the land's been degraded. What you saw over there was chickens, turkeys, and ducks basically using their foraging instincts. And these are all heritage breeds at this point. We didn't start raising hybrids until 2019.
You started with heritage breeds?
Yes, that's correct.
Why did you make that decision then?
I had a demand for it. People had asked me at my markets in the city. And they weren't our typical farmer's market customer that we see out here on the North Fork or in the Hamptons. These are folks that are from China, Korea, Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad and Tobago.
Was it from Eastern Europe or not?
Yeah, we have them too. But I would say less so than folks who are from Asia or the Caribbean. But there's not really Eastern Europeans. I had more Eastern European customers in Manhattan than I do in Brooklyn. Yeah, so people wanted these birds that they bred in their backyards where they lived.
In the countries they came from.
Yeah. I had a lot of experience with hybrids working for other poultry farmers out here. They're definitely a lot easier to raise than standard bred poultry. Because standard bred poultry, usually those breeds, especially the turkeys, they can fly, they roost in trees. Some of them are really wild and feral in their behavior, but that's how they survive out in a pasture-based environment. So it's really important that they have those behaviors in those standard bred.
How many different breeds do you have?
We have a game bird arm of our farm as well.
I don't even know what a game bird is.
Quail, a partridge, guinea hen. So those are game birds.
Oh, okay.
They have slight differences in their DNA that differentiate them from domestic poultry breeds.
there's a whole universe here of all these different breeds, and the interaction must be very interesting. Are they hazardous to each other, or have they learned how to coexist?
No. One of the things that Chris and I do as farmers is that we take the stewardship and the animal welfare of our bird as a top priority. And we don't want any cross-contamination of diseases amongst flocks. We obviously don't want them to fight because they very well could. Turkeys are notoriously mean to other breeds of birds, as are geese. So we're very, very careful to have our birds separated and in paddocks. So they get to free range on pasture. They have protection from their houses that they can seek out from aerial predators. We keep our guinea hens separate from our quail. Our quail are in a whole other field. They're over here. And all of the other breeds of birds that we have are on the north side of the North Road, so that they're not interacting. And another reason, like I said, is, you know, disease. And that's really important because we are raising them out on pasture. We don't use antibiotics. We will if we have to, because we're not organic or anything. But the whole point is to manage your birds in a way that has them healthy with the least amount of inputs as possible, right? Because antibiotics are expensive and they're extraordinarily detrimental to basically any kind of biological health.
Good time for you just to mention your website and the Good Shepherd one.
Oh, sure.
Talk about those two while I look at my notes.
Right. So the Good Shepherd Conservancy website is goodshepherdconservancy.org. And then you can find out so much about our farm at feistyacres.com.
Okay. What I'd written down was, when you were talking about the birds generally, that you're interested in their welfare and their well-being, or some words like that, I took up from the Good Shepherd Conservancy website, was that you're talking about tasty, nutrient-dense poultry from healthy and contented animals and happy, independent farmers. Mm-hmm. And humane butchery was another word. What is all of that? What does it all boil down to, as opposed to factory farming?
I'm going to just talk from my own experience and opinion as to what it is that I think those words mean. So let's go with animal welfare and making sure that your birds are safe and healthy and they're producing well and they're gaining weight. These are all things that you want to do. You can't have a good farm unless your animals are healthy. If they are not healthy, you are not going to be able to make money. That's just the long and the short of it, especially if you're a small farmer. So animal welfare to us means, here at Feisty Acres, that our birds are out on pasture for most of their lives. We strongly believe that them being on pasture not only offers them an extra food source, but it allows them to live out their natural behaviors, such as bathing in dust, chasing bugs, chasing mice, you know, doing all sorts of stuff, hunting. Chickens hunt, you know, they're omnivores, so they like to eat meat and vegetation. I want to make sure that my birds are healthy, so I have to manage them in our pasture in a way that makes sure that there's no cross-contamination, that our pastures are healthy so that they have adequate environment to live out their natural behaviors, a safe place to sleep at night. I want to make sure that they're protected from predators. That's really important. If they're being harassed by predators, they're not going to be happy birds. And then I think one of the most important things for us is that once the day comes that we need to slaughter or harvest our birds for market, we want it to just be one bad day, one bad moment in their life. So that's what we strive for. We want them to have one bad day in their life, whether that's for 6 weeks or for 6 months before they reach market. That's our job, and that's what animal welfare means to us here at Feisty Acres.
Okay, that's very interesting. So a few days earlier, we were going to meet, and then you said you couldn't because it was harvest day.
That's correct.
Talk more about just one bad day. You wanted them to have a good life where they're happy every day except the day, their last day.
Right.
Is that just a humane thing, or is it a financial, economic thing?
Those are inextricably tied. I really, really do believe that, especially if you're going to be as small as we are, those things have to be inextricably tied. If you don't have quality of product, you have nothing. Your customers won't come and buy it. If you don't have quality of product, that means your animals are sick or they're not doing well. They're unhappy for some sort of reason. So we really just want them to have that one bad day. Until we collect them, we bring them just, you know, right over here, 2 minutes away from where they lived their whole lives. And, you know, we kill them. They're dead within 10 seconds.
And they know that you're gathering them up to kill them?
I don't know, honestly. I mean, I don't feel that way. I feel like they are like, hey, why the heck are you just like grabbing us? Because we handle them all the time. That's another part of why our birds, I think our birds are healthy and happy, is because Chris and I see our birds, all of them, all the time, every day.
They all know you.
They all know us. They see us every day. They know who we are.
Farmer Abra Morwick is talking about maintaining a healthy and diverse poultry flock on her Feisty Acres farm. This is Norfolk Works on WPKN Radio.
So it's not like we're coming out of the blue and doing something terrible to them. We handle all the birds when they come out from the brooder. We have a brooder over there, and we pick up one by one and put them into crates, and then we drive them out to the pasture. They're hand-fed, hand-watered by us. Like, they get all that stuff. So I don't think they really know what's going on until they're upside down in a kill cone, and Chris is basically a second away from killing them. And
how do you kill them, manually? Or
Chris does that all by hand. He hand cuts every single bird. He makes sure that each and every cut is in the exact right place it needs to be.
So it's not really one bad day, it's one bad moment.
Yes,
A few bad minutes, maybe.
And you know, something else that we harp on about animal welfare, too, is that we've had to downsize our meat market because we don't have access to a state-inspected facility. We harvest at the farm, so we can only do 1,000 birds. And, you know, we have brought birds to other slaughterhouses that are USDA certified, and we were just not happy with the quality of the product because our standards are so high. The standards of the meat quality, and also the standards in which the birds are kept before they're brought into the slaughterhouse for slaughter.
Oh, so they were actually raised there in these
No. So a lot of folks who don't slaughter their own birds have to bring their birds to an inspected facility if they want to be able to sell them wholesale. And the cap to slaughtering birds on your farm here in New York State is 1,000 birds. That's it. In other states, it's 20,000. In another state, it's 24,000. But New York is not very friendly to small-scale poultry ag.
There's advocacy going on about that?
I don't think there's enough of us to really make a big stink out of it. This is really a dairy state. Here on the North Fork and on Long Island, nursery and sod are the biggest contributors to our agricultural GDP here.
And the vineyards?
Yeah, wineries are definitely counted as agriculture. I don't know what percentage of the market they make up.
You're sort of second-class citizens if you're not a...
I would say that our local Farm Bureau chapter here, the Long Island Farm Bureau, does a really good job to advocate for all of us.
Yeah.
Whether you're large or small. Rob Carpenter, he's regularly in touch with people who are members of the Farm Bureau at least once a year, no matter if you're a big farmer or a small farmer, no matter whether you do chickens or vegetables or nursery. We're very lucky.
Does that mean that you're never going to be able to get bigger?
Well, the only thing that I can do to get bigger is to have a slaughter facility that's either inspected by New York State, which is what I would prefer because I'm not interested in selling outside of state lines, or we could get a USDA facility. I go back and forth as to whether or not I'd want it to be private or public. I've seen issues with both. If I'm going to be investing my time and energy into something like that just to have it fail because there's too many moving parts, I wonder. But that's besides the point. I need a slaughterhouse. That's the long and the short of it. However, Chris and I have been able to grow our egg market dramatically, I would say about fourfold. So that's how we've been able to make up for the loss of our former state-inspected facility.
You grow your egg business just by having more chickens and
by quail? Having more egg layers, and more quail too. There's a huge quail egg market, and I beg people to raise quail around here because I don't know if Chris and I can do it all.
There's no limit on how many egg laying from the government's point of view. They don't get involved with how many.
Once you get over 3,000 egg layers, New York State definitely wants you to keep certain kinds of records. If you're selling wholesale, they definitely want to know stuff. But I would say 95% of our sales outside of the CSA are retail. I don't wholesale anything. I wholesale eggs every once in a while, but I don't need to. And we've got 600 laying chickens right now. We've got a lot.
You have these very loyal customers who come to the green market. Describe that part of your business going into town.
I go into the market once a week at Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn every Saturday. 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. I'm there slinging eggs and chickens and quail and whatever else I have. Yesterday I woke up at 2 a.m. not only to pack for market because we had a lot of stuff, I also had to pack up for our CSA members. Our CSA members come here and pick up at our farm usually on Saturdays, but some dribble in on Sundays.
I'm not sure everybody who's listening knows what a CSA is.
So CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and it's become kind of this loose, vague idea of people who are interested in being a part of the farm, and they purchase what's essentially a membership, whether that be weekly or monthly, and they purchase your membership up front in the winter, early spring months when farmers really need money to purchase seeds, purchase hatching eggs, Phyllis, because that's traditionally a slower time for farmers in our area. So it's an important part of having... Phyllis, hey, Phyllis!
A small disruption while the dog attacks a harmless neighbor walking past.
She's a tiny little beast. Come here. Sorry about that. So, essentially a membership.
Or could you call it a subscription? No.
Oh, absolutely. None of these words are regulated by anybody.
Well, membership is a more warm and fuzzy feeling.
Sure.
A subscription is a financial relationship.
Yes.
Membership is a human kind of belonging thing.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, I agree with you on that. That's a good way to
good.
Put it.
I wrote here, again, on the basis of the Good Shepherd Conservancy.
Sure.
They mentioned continuously bred flocks.
Mm, okay.
Why is this important?
If you're just raising standard bred birds to market and you're not breeding them on your farm yourself, you eventually will run out of birds to raise. And this makes you reliant on an outside source. Right now, besides our quail flock, which we're now breeding ourselves, we are 100% reliant upon hatcheries because we don't have any breeding flocks or pairs of any of the birds that we raise. So it's very important for biodiversity to survive in the poultry industry that more and more farms are breeding their own flocks so that if one farm, let's say, goes out of business, 20 other farms aren't affected.
Basically a supply issue.
Correct.
The general public has really come to understand very traumatically.
Correct.
The whole idea of disruption of the familiar is extremely traumatic for people.
I would argue that Americans are now just realizing what that's like. I would say most of the world knows what that's like. And we're so spoiled here.
I think Americans are realizing that you cannot take things for granted anymore.
Yeah.
It's very traumatic. It's very disruptive, destabilizing, mm-hmm. that you can't take for granted things you've always taken. Like the sun may not rise in the east tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know?
It's wild. People have really had to have changed their behaviors.
And it's this beginning. They haven't finished changing. We don't know what's coming up.
We're in the midst.
Yeah, even in the beginning, I don't know, but certainly the midst. A couple of questions I have about the Good Shepherd Conservancy.
Oh, sure.
Because I went through their website, which is very nice.
Yeah.
And I learned about all these cross F14 hybrids.
Yes.
And so what they're trying to do is encourage people to support the continuation of a particular breed. And they mention all of these breeds. Mm-hmm. They feature each one and they sing things like, "Help us save the Bourbon Red." Mm-hmm. And I don't know exactly how you help save the Bourbon Red or Narragansett.
Yes. There are dozens of different poultry breeds.
What are they asking you to do to help them?
The only way that farmers are going to be encouraged to continue to raise these breeds is if they can sell them. We already talked about the amount of resources you have to put into a bird, the amount of work you as the farmer has to put into in order to make sure that your birds live up to the standards of high animal welfare so that they can do what it is that a chicken does or a turkey does. And that's all well and good, but if the farmer cannot sell these birds, whether they be for meat or for eggs, then they're going to stop raising those birds. They're going to switch to something else.
They said you have to eat them in order to keep them alive.
That's correct. You have to eat them to save them. It's a mantra, basically, that people are echoing within this small movement. The Livestock Conservancy, they have a comprehensive list and catalog of all the different heritage breeds that need to be saved. You have to eat them to save them, right? So if you can't sell, let's say, a heritage turkey, that probably will cost anywhere between $180 and $200 at this point for like a sizable bird for Thanksgiving. You have to have a market to sell them to, right? If you don't have people to sell them to, then what's the point? So the strategy is to get people to start cooking them. I know that the Livestock Conservancy and Heritage Foods USA, they've been working a lot with chefs to get them to influence other people to eat these breeds, show them that they are delicious, that cooking them is not difficult, because you do have to cook heritage breed chickens and turkeys slightly different than your hybrid breeds. People need to be educated in how to cook these birds. Otherwise, they're not going to buy them. They'll have an unpleasant experience. It's a lot to get there. And until the market for heritage and standard bred poultry grows, the reality is that most people are going to have to sell their products to rich people exclusively.
Yeah, that's what, one of the questions I wrote down is, isn't this all very elite?
Yeah, yeah. Something that Chris and I struggle with a lot because, you know, we're not rich by any means. And the only way that we're able to eat the way that we're able to eat is because we're farmers. If I was making the money that I'm making now and I wasn't farming and growing food, I wouldn't shop at a farmer's market. I'll tell you that. But one of the things that Chris and I personally have done with our farm to try and mitigate this, and this by no means mitigates it in any significant way, but we're able to accept food stamps at our farmer's market.
Really?
Yeah. We usually get between $100 and $150 worth of people who have food stamps that buy like chicken or eggs from us. People like to buy livers from us.
Can you do that with your CSAs as well or no?
I asked my accountant to sign us up to be able to accept food stamps like through our website and stuff like that. So when CSA members want to sign up and maybe they can't exactly afford it, they can put their benefits to it. Another thing that I've always wanted to do, but, you know, Chris and I are only two people, so we couldn't possibly do this ourselves. But if anybody's listening and they want to help, that's cool. We've been inspired by other farms around the country, like Sylvan Aqua Farms in Virginia. They have a mutual aid program where they encourage people to basically fundraise, like, let's say $5,000 a month, so that the farmer, Chris Newman, can continue to farm. He's able to sell his chickens and his eggs to food pantries. And people in food pantries definitely need and want fresh meats and eggs and dairy more than they want vegetables and stuff like that. If anybody wants to help us out with that, run a mutual aid program so that we can get meat and eggs to people, but so that me as a farmer and Chris as a farmer can still make money, that would be amazing, right?
Yeah.
You can't really start serving people who aren't extraordinarily rich until you're a very large farm. We like to bash these really big farms all the time, but without them, so many people in our country would go hungry. That's a complicated issue.
But it's interesting, and I'm glad you talked about that with people. Is there anything else you want to say about what you're seeing this on the North Fork as a farmer?
Yeah, I'll never be able to buy a farm out here. We're very lucky that we're in a good spot where we are right now. We feel very safe here.
Have you said where it is?
Oh, yeah, Treber Farms. We lease 13.5 acres from them, and we're going to be leasing more from them, hopefully, either next year or the year after.
This is your first year?
Yes, it's our first year on the property. Mm. We moved in the middle of the winter last year.
Yeah, I remember when you moved.
Yeah, we were so lucky. So many people came out to help us.
Well, they all got used to seeing those little bird homes all over the little bird
tents, people.
You know.
Yeah, and they've become quite attached. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're still pretty visible. The quail houses are right over there. That's distressing not only to me, but so many other small farmers out here who don't own any land. And, you know, unfortunately, even conserved land, even land with its development rights sold, the market price is still $20,000 an acre.
Right.
Or more, depending upon where it is. And none of that land has infrastructure on it. Doesn't have a fence, a well, any barns to keep your equipment in, refrigeration. I mean, only really wealthy people will be able to buy farmland out here.
And probably that means it'll become more and more these small, sophisticated, niche kind of markets like birds.
Oh, for
rather
sure.
Rather than it'll
for
never
sure.
be cows,
for
you know.
No, and there's or just maybe, not enough farmland to support cows here on Long Island
it's
effectively.
Stuff, maybe.
I would agree with you on that. I think small ruminants and poultry in terms of livestock is the way to go, outside of the fisheries and baymen and baywomen, of course. But yeah, it's, you know, my argument always is to, I try to stand up for most farmers, not just farmers like me, but, you know, say what you will about certain farms, but at least it's not an apartment complex.
Or a marina on Matatuck Inlet.
100%.
Well, thank you very much. Abra, once more, tell them where they can get in touch with you.
Through our website at www.feistyacres.com.
Abra Morawick, thank you so much. I'm so glad that we had a chance to talk.
It's always a pleasure to have you here, Hazel. Thank you.
It's a very nice way to spend an afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You heard farmer Abra Morawick talking about maintaining a healthy and diverse poultry flock on her Feisty Acres farm. You can hear North Fork Works on the first Wednesday of every month at this time and any time at all as podcasts on hazelcarn.com. Thank you for listening to WPKN. I'm Hazel Kahn.